first and foremost, thank you so much to the people at No Boston 2024. Thank you so much. So it's been a slow news week in sports, hasn't it? Yeah, not a lot going on. So if people hadn't heard the news from today, Seth Blatter, the racist, sexist, homophobic, reptilian con artist, who's been in charge of world soccer for the last 17 years, is now officially out of a job. Or he is trying to choreograph the leaving of his job, but something tells me that boot is going to hit him in the ass faster than he thinks. And, you know, of course this raises a question, like, is there a difference between FIFA and the IOC? I get asked that a lot. What's better? What's worse? What can we learn from FIFA? And I think the best way to understand the difference between FIFA and the IOC is that one is a group of corrupt, inbred, aristocratic royalists, and the other is FIFA. But actually, there are some important differences between FIFA and the IOC. The most important difference is that FIFA is self-funding. FIFA reaps billions upon billions of dollars from the cash cow that is world soccer, and they get it from places far flung across the globe. So that also means that FIFA is not dependent on the United States for money, which means FIFA can also afford to thumb its nose at the United States when it feels like it, which to me has always been the most charming part of FIFA. The IOC, in contrast, depends upon the United States for funding. Without the United States funding, there would not be an IOC. And that is why, with a metronomic regularity, the Olympics show up in the United States. That is why people in Boston are right to be extremely concerned about 2024, because as it's been said time and again, it is your turn. It is Boston's turn, and the IOC knows that it has to feed the United States Olympic Committee, and that means bringing the Olympics to Boston. You should view this as something very real that could happen. As awful as everything that Cade laid out, you might think that just the power of Cade's argument alone, the force gale of it, would make people say, it's not going to come to Boston, it's just too much, it's just too much. Well, guess what? It's always too much, no matter the city. But very briefly about Seth Blatter, because a couple people asked me to say, it's like, why is it that this person is gone, this person so entrenched in power? Why this person who won re-election 4 days ago just resigned? Which is kind of a dick move, I think, to hold the election and then 4 days later just be like, yeah, I'm out. Because I want to choreograph my own successor. But the question is really like, why is the U.S. Justice Department, which I think people are right to look at with one eyebrow raised, why is the U.S. Justice Department the motor engine of getting rid of Seth Blatter? And if you look online, you see a lot of conspiracy theories about why this was the case. All kinds of things are out there about why it is that the United States is trying to depose Seth Blatter. And you read this stuff, and after all, it makes it sound as if almost like FIFA is this revolutionary force that the U.S. is trying to put down by any means necessary. And you see otherwise really smart people being like, I stand with FIFA against U.S. imperialism. And you're like, what? No, no, no. That's not the best way to frame this discussion. Because FIFA is really bad. And sometimes the most simple explanation is the correct explanation. So why is the U.S. Justice Department, why'd they go after FIFA? Three big reasons. First, the United States did not get the 2022 World Cup. The U.S. wanted the 2022 World Cup. If they had gotten the 2022 World Cup, this would not have happened. That's the first reason. Very simply, that's how you explain it in one sentence why the U.S. is doing this. They didn't get the damn World Cup. And so there was an undercurrent of a lot of pissed offness in very high circles. The second reason is that this is really low-hanging fruit for the U.S. Justice Department. I mean, they have been under a lot of criticism because perpetrators of the largest financial heist in the history of heists, a.k.a. the 2008 economic crisis, not one bankster has found their way behind bars. And so this is a way to go after a 1% organization to stage an arrest in a 5-star Zurich hotel with no fallout from Wall Street. So this is terrific. You look muscular. It's bipartisan. This is low-hanging fruit for the Justice Department. Could not be better. I mean, if you're going to arrest some rich people, FIFA is the rich people arrestees of choice by the U.S. Justice Department. But the last reason, it's really the most simple one whatsoever. And that's this. The people who perpetrated these hundreds of millions of dollar bribery schemes in the United States, that was untaxed money. And one thing you don't get between is the United States and its money. Remember what took down Capone? It wasn't the murder. It was that he didn't pay his taxes. And this is a similar case. You have a guy named Chuck Blazer, who was once one of the top figures in FIFA, who is so wealthy that people might have heard this. His cat had its own apartment in Trump Tower. And he hadn't paid taxes for years. And that wasn't going to happen. The U.S. got him to wear a wire, and the rest is criminal justice history. So that's that situation, and it's worth, you know, I felt like it was worth laying out everything that went into it, because it's worth knowing that the United States and FIFA, you're talking about kind of like hostile brethren here. It's like working with FIFA, not big fans of FIFA. The United States and the IOC, it's a little different. The IOC is much more like an extension of the United States. And the Olympics are coming to the U.S. one way or another, one year or another, and it's your job to make sure it's not Boston in 2024. And just so folks, I'm sure there are folks here who have no idea who I am, what I do, and I just want to say like where I'm coming from on this is that I've either covered or been forcibly asked to leave the airport of every Olympics or World Cup since 9/11. And couldn't get out of the airport in Beijing. And everywhere I've been, these are profoundly different countries that have hosted the World Cup and the Olympics. I mean, there are huge, obviously, differences between China, South Africa, Canada. I mean, these are not exactly similar countries in terms of economics, GDP, all the rest of it. Yet each place, you see the same thing. You see debt, displacement, and the militarization of public space. Every single place. It just takes on the characteristics of the given city or country. And the stories that I could tell you about what I've seen, I mean, there are things, honestly, that keep me up nights when I think about them. Like, you think about Greece in 2002. Where the Olympics went something like 1,500% over budget and played a role actually in precipitating the largest economic crisis in the history of Greece, to the point of which there are homeless families now living in dilapidated Olympic structures in Athens. It's the place where they've been able to find shelter, is an Olympic structure that's been allowed to decay. That's the Olympic legacy in Greece. Or South Africa. I went to a stadium in South Africa, in Durban, where the grass was so incredibly green and beautiful, it looked like each individual blade had been colored in with a Crayola magic marker. And it was so green because they were irrigating it 24 hours a day. We were a 10-minute walk from the start of a township that was undergoing a water shortage so severe, trucks would have to drive with jugs in the middle of the night to prevent babies from dehydrating and having to be rushed to the hospital. This is happening simultaneously, side by side. And then there's Brazil, where I spent a great deal of time because, you know, Olympics and World Cup all in one country. The World Cup and the Olympics, these sports mega events, are so toxic, it actually drove the people of Brazil to protest soccer. Think about that for a second. Think about this. The largest protests in Brazil since the fall of the dictatorship in the 1980s were against the spending priorities of the World Cup. This would be like New Yorkers protesting pizza. I mean, it has no logical connection if you know the love of soccer in Brazil, but it made perfect sense to people there because of this, the pain that people felt at seeing these stadiums get built while there were drastic shortages in education and in healthcare. And I want to tell two quick stories from Brazil that give at least a sense of why I think so much of what I'm talking about, debt, displacement, militarization, why it's not part of just like the dialogue of how we talk about these things. I mean, you hear all the time about the glories and the gold medals and the pride of hosting. You don't hear about the incredible cost that cities pay. And I just want to give one example of a reason why. When I was in Brazil, I was having breakfast one morning with someone who's a high-ranking commentator on a certain sports network. And I don't want to say the name of the sports network to protect his privacy, because he was speaking to me in confidence. I don't want to say the name of the four-letter sports network that was to say where he was from. Quite the worldwide leader, this person, though. I got to tell you, he's very impressive. And I was sitting with him, and he was complaining about his network's lack of coverage of the problems in the favelas, of poverty, of the suffering in Brazil. And he was angry about it. And he said, "You want to hear the worst part? They gave us panic buttons." And I said, "What are you talking about?" And he said, "Look at this." And he takes a little square out of his pocket with a red button on it. And he said, "They gave this to all the reporters. And the idea is if we ever felt like we were in a dangerous situation, to press one of these buttons and a black SUV would come for us and they would throw us in the back and whisk us back to the hotel to safety." Now, my first thought was like, I didn't know a panic button was like a real thing. You know, it's like, you know, you always hear like, don't press the panic button, you know, but it's like,
oh my God,
that's a panic button. That's what that is. And he was so angry about it because this is a seasoned journalist with some really good chops. And he would say, they give these things to the young reporters, the people who've never been to Brazil, the people who might have some curiosities about what takes place. And the message they tell them before they even leave headquarters is be afraid. Be fearful of what you see around you. And that cloisteredness of the international sports media and the fact that the sports media is broadcast partners with FIFA, with the IOC, because that's what this bribery has been all about, is broadcast rights. That's what's so precious, these broadcast rights. I mean, it speaks to why we don't get the truth about these mega events, because the very people we depend on for that truth have a vested interest or are ordered to not tell us what's happening. And another example of that was I was on an NPR show talking about the problems in Brazil during the World Cup, and I was on with another prominent media member, and he was saying that I wasn't being truthful about the fact that people in Brazil were upset with the World Cup. He said, that's absolutely not true, because I was saying things that I had witnessed, like whole rooms of people in Brazilian bars rooting against Brazil as a point of pride, because they were so angry about the World Cup. And telling stories about the fact that, like, even in the airport, there were stickers everywhere that people put up that said in Portuguese, actually in five different languages, they say, "We don't want the World Cup, no to FIFA." I told about my friend who said to me that the word FIFA in Brazil had become like the word FEMA in New Orleans after Hurricane Katrina. So I'm hearing these stories, and I'm telling this on the radio, and the person says to me, this is propaganda, that's absolutely untrue. And the NPR person said, "Well, please explain." And I'm like, "Yeah, please explain. I want to hear this too." And he said, "Look," this is almost an exact quote. He said, "Look, I take cabs every day in Rio, and the cab drivers tell me how happy they are."
Was it Tom Friedman?
It wasn't Tom Friedman, but that was me. I was talking to my cab driver about cell phone coverage in Saipan. And I realized globalization works. But, God, I don't know if there are people here who can we all agree that Tom Friedman is a braying jackass? Yeah. That's a good point of agreement. Good. Glad we all feel that. But the crazy thing is, and when he said this, I laughed, like, involuntarily when he said that. Because I also took a bunch of cabs when I was down there in Brazil. And I don't want to shock anybody, but cab drivers tend to tell you what you want to hear. So they get these things called tips, which supports their things called lives. And like, I laughed because I had this one experience. I was with someone who was translating for me, and the cab driver, I say to the cab driver through the translator, I said, like, "Hey, what do you think about the World Cup?" And his response was, Oh, my American friend, I love the World Cup. It's amazing. I've met people from all over the world. The excitement, the intensity. I'm so happy." And then I was translated back, and I said, well, can you tell him that I'm a journalist and I'm writing about the problems in the World Cup? And they did that, and the cab driver goes, oh, the World Cup, I hate it. How things it's doing to this country. I despise what's happening. So it's just like the idea that cab drivers are going to be his evidence. It was says so much. And I could talk about Brazil all day long. I'm not going to do that. But the other example I want to give, the example that to me, like, damns mega events, not, like, for all times, is what's happening in Qatar right now. And I see that there is a lot of familiarity with what's happening. But the death at this point of 1,200 migrant workers. And it's impossible actually to know how much of that has happened because of building World Cup structures and how much of that is just the death of migrant workers since the World Cup was awarded to Qatar. But the number is 1,200, and it's estimated that it could go up to 4,000 by the time the World Cup is played in 2022. 4,000. In Brazil, the number was 9, the number of workers died. And I can tell you, every time a worker died, there were demonstrations, it was the cover of the newspaper, there was outrage, there was horror. 9. 1,200. And 2 separate camera crews were arrested by the Qatar government just in the last couple of weeks for trying to film what was happening there. And most of the deaths are happening because people are working without water in incredible heat. And it's a process that they call their hearts are exploding in their chests the second they have a moment to rest. Their passports have been taken away. Workers have issued complaints about slavery. Like, just they're not being paid, their passports are taken, and they're being forced to work for water, saying, you're in the heat, we're not going to give you water. This is what FIFA has given to the people of Nepal working in Qatar. But you know who's done very well already from the Qatar World Cup? Someone who has gotten hundreds of thousands of dollars from the Qatar committee for the World Cup and millions of dollars from the Qatar government is Bill Clinton. Person we were talking about before, he's the hero of this evening. Like, so it's like, so this idea, like, there is just this international coterie of parasitic elements that see these mega events as neoliberal Trojan horses and the ability to go into countries and push through a kind of sporting shock doctrine of a whole series of programs that they never would be able to get away with otherwise, but they're able to get away with it because it comes wrapped in sports. And it goes wrapped in the excitement of sports. And the difference in Brazil is that people stood up. People stood up in 2013 by the millions and said, we don't want this for our country. And the difference in Boston is that you're standing up right now. And that cannot be more significant. You're going to have to... I was driving here with Robin. Where's Robin? With Robin. And we were talking about Robin's lived in Boston over 10 years, 11 years? 10, give it. And Robin was saying that she liked Boston because she said it has a certain vibe. And she says she likes living here, despite the fact that it's getting expensive and all the rest of it. That was the phrase she used. It had a certain vibe. And I didn't tell you this because I wanted to save it for this moment, but when you said that, a chill ran up my spine because I know someone from Atlanta who told me that they loved the city until 1996. And what they said was, it had a vibe that was destroyed by the Olympics coming here. And if you meet people from Atlanta, they'll tell you, they speak about the city as a before and after Olympic situation. Where in 96, what they loved about the city was stamped out for the purposes of creating this kind of dystopic McDonald's city, hyper-construction, all the rest of it, hyper-gentrification, and hyper-attacks on people's living situations. So now the IOC is in your town. It's in your town. And your mission, should you choose to accept it, is to make the situation for the International Olympic Committee so uncomfortable every time they come here that they decide this is not where they want to be. Your mission, should you choose to accept it, is to find out what hotel they're staying in and have yourself a big drum party in the lobby. That's what they did in Chicago. And the only way they were able to get them out of the lobby when they were trying to get in Chicago was they actually were invited up to the room of the IOC delegates where they actually sat down with the IOC and talked about the history of police violence in Chicago, the history of gentrification in Chicago, and they also talked about the L train and how completely inadequate it is for the daily commute, let alone for the Olympics. And they basically scared them into saying, not here. And that's your job. And if there's one last thing I want to say, it's to keep in mind that this is, you're going to be accused of being what's called a NIMBY. People might have heard that word, not in my backyard. Like, okay, it won't be in Boston, but you'll make some other country have to deal with it. If people tell you that, that's
garbage.
And it's garbage because countries around the world are organizing to reject the Olympics. The Olympics are running out of places that want to host them. And the less they can find places to host them, the more likely it is that they'll either radically reform or crack up as FIFA is now and be rebirthed as something much more just. Because everything they say that they say is true is a lie. It's like some weird bizarro world. They say it promotes youth sports, while at the same time when I was in Vancouver for the Winter Games, the cover of the paper was how youth sports were being slashed dramatically. And then the bottom of the front page of the paper, totally unrelated story, was about how they were having to fly snow at the cost of hundreds of thousands of dollars to the top of a mountain because they didn't have enough snow for skiing. So everything they'll tell you is a lie. So it's like on the basis of reclaiming international sports, on the basis of making the sports world more just, and on the basis of saving your city, rejecting the Olympics is absolutely not just the right thing to do for you, but it's the moral thing to do from an internationalist perspective. And it makes it less likely. And it can't be said enough. This was something I've been reporting on nonstop, but it can't be said enough. Is that the reason why Boston leapfrogged cities like Los Angeles and Washington, D.C., where I live, to become the USOC representative, is that the IOC was profoundly impressed with how the city shut itself down after the marathon bombing. So you think about that for a second. Think about the fear, the chaos, like the just the horribleness of that moment. And the IOC is populated with people who saw that situation and saw opportunity. And that in and of itself is a reason to reject this, because it's a kind of dystopic worldview that they hold. But if you don't do it for yourself, if you don't do it for the folks around the world, if you don't do it for any other reason, do it for a guy named Kohei Gino. Anybody ever heard that name, Kohei Gino? I want to end by putting Kohei Gino in your mind. Kohei Gino was a young man in 1964 when the Olympics came to Tokyo. And he found himself displaced from his home. He was kicked out to make way for Olympic facilities. He was devastated. He lived his whole life building up his poor kid to a point where he's a small shop owner, and right now he's an elderly gentleman who has rebuilt his life after that horror of 64. Several months ago, he was displaced again to make way for the 2024 Olympics, the 2020 Olympics in Tokyo. And this is Kohei Gino, this is what he said. He said, "I wish they wouldn't have the Olympics in Tokyo again. I can bear getting evicted if it's just once in a century. But twice? That's just ridiculous." Kohei Gino's absolutely right. This is ridiculous. It's a mockery of sports. It's a mockery of development. And it's a mockery of the good people of Boston to try to sell you guys the snake oil that Boston 2024 is trying to sell. So reject it, and reject it proudly. Thank you so much.